ebooks.
Hello and welcome back to Epochs. If you watch Epochs every week, you'll know that I've been doing the series, continuing my series all about the English monarchy. And we got through to the end of Henry VIII. So before I go on to his son, Edward VI, and then Lady Jane Grey, and then Bloody Mary, and then Elizabeth, Good Queen Bess, and on and on and on, I thought I'd take a little bit of a break, do something else for a few episodes, a little bit of a palate cleanser. One can have perhaps too much of the English monarchy if it's for months and months and months on end. So I'm going to do something a little bit different for a few episodes. Now, what I've decided I want to do is I want to talk all about Constantine the Great. So we're going back to the Roman era, the ancient world or late antiquity, the 3rd century AD. Now, Constantine the Great, Constantine the First, is such a giant figure, one of those titans of history, someone that dominates history in all sorts of ways, such a huge figure, that I want to be able to set up the story. I don't just want to start with Constantine's early life. I want to set up the whole story. And it's one of those things when you're trying to do a narrative, to tell a story. Epochs history is really storytelling, isn't it? Where to begin? You know, can you really tell the story of World War II without telling the story of the interwar years? Can you really tell that story without talking about World War I? Can you really tell that story without talking about Bismarck, without going back to the era, and so on and so on? Where to begin? Really, where to begin? So for this, I've made the executive decision, the creative decision, that I least want to talk all about the main reign that came directly before Constantine, which is that of Diocletian. So what I'm going to do is spend an episode or two, maybe three, who knows, we'll see where it goes, talking all about Diocletian. So we lead the whole generation before Constantine, so that it really, really sets up that whole world. Why Constantine did what he did. What was the world like when he was a child, his formative years? What was rolling around in his experience, in his memory banks, by the time he entered the stage of history? So, and Diocletian is absolutely fascinating and a brilliant story all in and of himself. So I'm going to talk all about Diocletian here for an episode or two. But where to even begin that? So I've decided what I'll do is spend 5, 10, maybe 15 minutes talking to you all about the period running up to Diocletian. That's where I'm going to start it. I'm going to do a brief overview of what led to the reign of Diocletian, ultimately all setting up the stage for the story of Constantine. All right, so Diocletian and the world he lived in. That story is really the story of the so-called crisis of the 3rd century, the 3rd century being the 200s AD. So a little bit of an overview, could do episodes, multiple episodes all about this, but the creative decision I've made is to do that in a bit of an overview, broad sweeps of the brush before we start getting into all sorts of detail. By the way, I'm going to be reading from Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon, written at the end of the 18th century. So no woke, you don't have to worry about revisionism and wokeness. I'm a big fan. I think I've mentioned it more than once. In fact, I know I have, how good I think The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon is. Many consider it the gold standard of Roman history. Some people don't particularly like Gibbon, but I think they're wrong. I think it's brilliant, superbly well written, impeccably researched, and all that sort of thing, in my opinion. So, the crisis of the 3rd century, what was that? Well, it was where the Roman Empire began to fracture and fall apart. Ever since the reign of Augustus, and that is around the year zero, around the age of Christ, so it begins his reign in 31 BC, or arguably 27 BC, in the decades before zero AD. And he doesn't die until sort of 14 AD. That's Augustus. Now, ever since then, really, the Republic was dead. Historians, scholars argue exactly when the Republic died. Most agree it was probably under Julius Caesar, almost certainly under Augustus, and certainly Augustus's immediate successors, people like Tiberius and Caligula. The Republic was really dead. The Senate did not control policy anymore. It was in the hands of the emperors. Nonetheless, the pretense of the Republic was still continued. There still was a Senate, and all the emperors pretended, paid lip service to all the institutions and norms of the Republic. But really, the cockpit of power, you know, who gets to really set policy, was with the emperors and their inner entourages. You know, like, so Tiberius and Caligula really didn't, particularly Caligula, or by the age of Nero, we're talking like the 60s AD then, a generation or two after Augustus, really the Senate was for rubber stamping only. I mean, Nero butchered most of the Senate. And then there's centuries after that. We're going to talk about the crisis of the third century for a bit here. So, you know, a couple of centuries after all of that has gone down. By the beginning, the middle of the third century, the 200s AD, Rome in all sorts of ways has passed its glory days, the glory days of perhaps the Antonines. Again, historians and scholars argue about really this. Antonius Pius, Trajan, Hadrian, all those, the second century, right? Rome has declined. By the third century, Rome has declined from its high watermark. A lot of people say the highest watermark is Trajan or Hadrian, where Hadrian decides to put definite limits on the empire. No longer are they sort of the Roman world, endlessly looking to expand. Hadrian says, no, look, it's already too big in all sorts of ways. We're going to try and hold on to what we've got. And the empire stretches from northern England, or modern day Scotland, Britannia, they called it, the Roman province of Britannia, all the way from the Hadrian's Wall, or the Wall of the Antonines up in Scotland, all the way out to modern day Iraq, like the city of Ctesiphon, which is basically sort of modern day Baghdad. So the Roman Empire, all of North Africa, all of Europe, not really much of Germany or Poland or Northern Europe, but all of modern day France and Spain, Italy, the Balkans, Turkey, and the Levant, the Holy Land, and all the way out to Mesopotamia. So it's a giant, giant empire. And Hadrian decides to put limits on that. Okay, in the next century or so, Rome struggles to keep hold of that. And it goes through all sorts of turmoil, both military and economic. The empire keeps getting invaded endlessly, really, by all the quote-unquote barbaric peoples that surround it, kind of endlessly. And it goes through political turmoil as well as military turmoil, lots and lots and lots of different emperors. They keep usurping each other. The empire breaks up a bit and then is reunited under Aurelian. I've considered starting this story with Aurelian, one of the great, great emperors in the crisis of the third century, where it looked like the Roman Empire was truly fracturing and for good. Aurelian unites it again under the control of one man, him. Aurelian could have been a Constantine type figure, dominated history, a titan of history. Everyone would know his name millennia later. But relatively soon after he united the empire, he dies, he's killed. And so it fractures again. We just get another cycle of classic stuff of the crisis of the third century. Also, must say, economically, all sorts of problems. The Romans increased their army. They doubled the size of their army during the crisis of the third century because of the endless invasions from all the different tribes around them. And they had to increase the pay of the soldiers, something in the order of 50%. And the Roman economy just wasn't up to that, essentially. So they had to devalue their money. They had to make their gold and, more importantly, silver pieces. They had to water down the amount of actual silver that's in it. Okay, so it's a crisis. Military, political, and economic crisis over and over and over again. Until we get to the age of Diocletian. Okay, now, one of the main things to say, spoiler alert, but we'll go into all this in tons of detail, but to give you the overview so you know what you're listening to, what's coming, Diocletian brings in a whole new system of government. From Augustus to Diocletian, historians have called it the Principate. That is, that the emperor is supposed to be, just on paper, it's supposed to be the princeps, the first citizen. Some historians and scholars say that all of those emperors, I don't agree with this, a lot of people don't agree with it, but the argument has been made, that all of those emperors from Augustus to Diocletian aren't true emperors in the way let's say, perhaps Napoleon was an emperor, that at least on paper, the Senate still exists. Okay, lots of the institutions of the Republic still exist, whether it's a sham or not. They're those emperors are supposed to be, of course they weren't really in practice, but they were supposed to be just the first among equals. They're supposed to be merely the first citizen. Okay, that was what the government was supposed to be, a principate. Well, when Diocletian comes in, he changes that. He brings in what historians call the dominate, i.e. a true emperor. The empire is embodied in the person of the emperor now. He dominates it, right? His word is law. But now formally, legally, he doesn't have to have any recourse to a Senate or anything like that. He is a true, true emperor in the classic sense of the word. Literally, whatever he says is now law. And so, although that had been the case in practice, for nearly all of the principate, now what Diocletian does is he sort of formalizes it. And he's a true military emperor. It's his way or the highway, and there's no ifs or buts about it, even nominally, even on paper. Okay. The other big thing he does is he unifies the empire, as Aurelian had done only a generation or so before. But then he decides, he makes a decision, a big, big decision, like that of Hadrian, to put limits on the empire. He decides he's going to change the game a bit, and he's going to make four emperors, him being one of them. The empire is just too big to be ruled by one person. He's going to break it up into four segments. The Tetrarchy, it's called, the rule of four, the Tetrarchy. And what in his idea was that you would have two senior emperors, again, him being one. In his idea was that you would have two senior emperors, again, him being one of those. And they will be called Augustuses or Augusti. And they will name, formally, legally, name their successor. Each one of them will name their successor, and they will be called a Caesar. Okay, so you can already see, a couple of centuries out from the original Julius Caesar and Octavian, Augustus, the Augustus, a couple of centuries out, the Roman world is already looking back on that with rose-tinted glasses. Already, it's already something that's completely in the past, just a part of their history. They're now playing a different game, an entirely different game. And this Tetrarchy, you'll have two senior emperors, the Augusti, and two junior ones. And as soon as one of those Augustuses, Augusti, as soon as they die, or if they might like to retire, then the idea is that there'll be no succession crisis because you've already got another guy, your Caesar, will take over and be promoted effectively to an Augustus. And then he, at that point, will then name a new Caesar. So there'll be no succession crisis. That's the idea. And that with the empire broken up into four bits, each one of these Augusti or Caesars, they will be able to rule their portion of the empire much more effectively, efficiently. And it will prevent, again, in theory, it will prevent something like the crisis of the third century just playing out endlessly, i.e. just succession crisis after succession crisis after succession crisis. That's the idea of it. Of course, you might already be asking yourself, well, what if these four emperors don't necessarily all agree perfectly with each other and are all on the same page with each other in terms of policy 100% of the time? What if they start fighting among themselves? I mean, it's a good question. So, all right, with all of that said, give you a bit of an overview of what's going to go down. Let's start talking about and reading about Diocletian himself. So, as I said, I'm going to be reading from Edward Gibbon. And in chapter 13 of his seminal work, he says this, quote, "As the reign of Diocletian was more illustrious than that of any of his predecessors, so was his birth more abject and obscure. The strong claims of merit and of violence had frequently superseded the ideal prerogatives of nobility." What he's talking about there is usurpations, the idea that you're of a noble family, like the Julio-Claudian dynasty, that protects you in some way, that you won't be usurped because the name, your very name and your family means that no one could really take your position because they won't be illustrious enough, they won't be noble enough. Well, all of that's out of the window a long time ago. But a distinct line of separation was hitherto preserved between the free and the servile part of mankind. The parents of Diocletian had been slaves in the house of Anulinius, a Roman senator, nor was he himself distinguished by any other name than that which he derived from a small town in Dalmatia, from whence his mother deduced her origin. It is, however, probable that his father obtained the freedom of the family, and that he soon acquired an office of scribe, which was commonly exercised by persons of his condition. Favourable oracles, or rather the consciousness of superior merit, prompted his aspiring son to pursue the profession of arms and the hopes of fortune, i.e. joining the army. And it would be extremely curious to observe the graduation of arts and accidents which enabled him in the end to fulfil these oracles and to display that merit to the world. Diocletian was successively promoted to the government of Maesia, the honours of the consulship, and the important command of the guards of the palace. End quote. So right there, we're told that Diocletian comes from kind of nothing, not absolutely nothing at all, not sort of a true peasant living in filth and penury, but still not a noble family whatsoever. But he joined the army and through his own merits ended up becoming consul. Now, you remember me telling you just a few moments ago about how many of the institutions of the Republic had still survived, like consuls, praetors, proconsuls, quaestors, all that sort of thing, tribunes. They still all existed. Of course, they didn't have anywhere near the power or the prestige that they had once done during the age of the Republic, but they all still existed. So to become a consul was still massively important. He was still one of the most powerful people in the empire, and he was able to do that through his own merits and became, and this is the key, the command of the guards of the palace. And that's a classic thing all down through history, isn't it? Whoever gets put in charge of the actual personal safety of the emperor, that's extremely powerful, isn't it? Extremely, extremely powerful. Or if you're the one who gatekeeps the emperor, this is all through Chinese history, medieval history, all down through history. If you're in charge of gatekeeping the emperor and you're in charge of his personal safety, you're very, very close to being as powerful as him. It's in your hands to have him murdered if you wanted to, right? You're in charge of whether his enemies get access to him and murder him and conduct a coup d'etat. Well, in a de facto sense, you're almost as powerful as him, if not more, you could argue, right? If you look at the Carolingian Empire, the people that controlled the palace, the security of the palace, eventually became the kings. Story as old as time. Okay, so that's where Diocletian finds himself. Gibbon goes on saying, he distinguished his abilities in the Persian War, and after the death of Numerian, the emperor, the slave, by the confession and judgment of his rivals, was declared the most worthy of the imperial throne. So one of the emperors, Numerian, did in fact get himself killed and usurped. And it's none other than the commander of the palace and an ex-consul, Diocletian, who takes the throne next, or is given the throne next, the imperial diadem. The malice of religious zeal, whilst it arraigns the savage fierceness of his colleague, Maximian, has affected to cast suspicion on the personal courage of the Emperor Diocletian. End quote. So something to say there. Diocletian had a right-hand man, this chap called Maximian. Now, Maximian plays a massive role in our story here. The story of Diocletian is also the story of Maximian. Okay, we talked about the rule of four, which doesn't happen yet. It's not for a few years, a good couple of years yet before this happens. But this Maximian is one of the Augustus, the Augusti. Diocletian makes himself and Maximian the two senior emperors, his colleague, as Edward Gibbon describes it. And this Maximian is supposed to be very, very short. He's a true military man, a true just soldier. If anyone or anything ever gets in his way, he just destroys them, kills them. Diocletian isn't necessarily like that. Sometimes he is a bit, but he tries to rule as something other than a completely naked military despot, whereas Maximian doesn't. Maximian doesn't care. Okay, so that's a name to remember. And Edward Gibbon mentions there that Diocletian himself might not necessarily have been, a true soldier in that sense of getting involved in swordplay whenever he can, being the first over a wall, being the first to lead a charge in battle. That's the sort of person, kind of, that Maximian was, but that's not the type of guy that Diocletian was. Historians and scholars have argued about that exactly, because we have some warrior kings and some warrior emperors throughout time, don't we? Like Alexander. Julius Caesar himself would get involved in battles, personally get involved in battles, fighting on the front line with his men. Diocletian wasn't like that. But probably, or well, wasn't a coward in any way. Far from it. Politically fearless. Okay, Gibbon goes on saying, quote, "It would not be easy to persuade us of the cowardice of a soldier of fortune who acquired and preserved the esteem of the legions as well as the favour of so many warlike princes. Yet even Culmany is sagacious enough to discover and to attack the most vulnerable part. The valour of Diocletian was never found inadequate to his duty or to the occasion, but he appears not to have possessed the daring and generous spirit of a hero who courts danger and fame, disdains artifice, and boldly challenges the allegiance of his equals. His abilities were useful rather than splendid, a vigorous mind improved by the experience and study of mankind," i.e. he wasn't a mindless soldier, a mindless butcher, but he sort of studied people and understood human psychology and politics. Gibbon says he had dexterity and application in business, a judicious mixture of liberality and economy, of mildness and rigour, profound dissimulation under the disguise of military frankness, steadiness to pursue his ends, flexibility to vary his means, and above all, the great art of submitting his own passions, as well as those of others, to the interests of his ambition, and of colouring his ambition with the most specious pretences of justice and public utility," end quote. It's a way of saying, a very roundabout late 19th century way of saying, that he was prudent. He would do what was ever in his best interests, or the empire's best interests, at any given moment. That he wasn't ruled by his passions. That he wasn't massively headstrong or an ideologue. He was prudent. A politician, you might say. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotusetus.com for the full unabridged video.